now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, we'll discuss Liverpool's incredible 9-0 win over Bournemouth this weekend. Is there a mental block when it comes to scoring 10? And what are the prospects for Scott Parker's side in the Premier League this season? We'll also be talking about Erling Haaland and Manchester City. What about their defence as he becomes the flat-track bully that might just fire them to the Premier League title? We'll be talking about pressure for Steven Gerrard at Aston Villa, Richarlison's silky showboating, and we'll also pick our Player of the Month nominations, all that and more in the next hour or so on The Game. Hello again and welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Hugh Wisencroft alongside Tom Roddy and Alison Rudd this week. Loads to discuss. I've got to say, the Premier League's keeping its consistency in terms of entertainment. I'm not liking the fact that the commentators have picked up on it, though, and they keep remarking about how fantastic a league it is. Slightly belittling to fans of other divisions, I think. But we had a 9-0 this weekend, so I think we're allowed, okay, to eulogise about the Premier League a little bit. Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool bouncing back from that lacklustre display at Old Trafford with a sensational win at home to Bournemouth. They become just the fourth team in the Premier League era to notch a record 9-0 victory. For Bournemouth, I think it underlines a weak summer of transfers will come to them, though. Five players brought in, three of those on frees, none that look like they'll make a huge impact in the English top flight. So much so that Jurgen Klopp had to give Scott Parker a little cuddle, okay? Because that was the difference in the quality between the two teams. Alison, you were there. What was the best thing about Liverpool's win?
The best thing about Liverpool's win was that it wasn't dictated by how poor Bournemouth were. Liverpool went at Bournemouth as if it was the second leg of a European Cup tie and they were 3-0 down and they were playing Real Madrid or Barcelona or PSG. They went for it. They went for the jugular. The intensity, we had two goals in 6 minutes, and that sounds weird to say it, but you felt they were coming. It was overwhelming, the amount of pressure they put on Bournemouth. And so that sort of sense of, you know, rolling up your sleeves and putting the cobwebs away and sort of resetting after a poor start to the season was really palpable. And then what happened was that I don't think Bournemouth realised they were going to be subject to that. And they were completely, Scott Parker called it shell-shocked, but that's how they looked. It's like one of those scenes from those war movies when you've got young men who don't know what's hit them. They didn't know how to recover. And then, so it was deserved in that sense. It was about the team that scored nine, not so much about the team that conceded the nine in the sense of what Liverpool did to them to cause them to wobble. And then Anfield became very respectful. The goals, as it became clear, there was going to be a lot of goals. There wasn't, there were no cruel chanting. The goals weren't even celebrated too much until it got to nine. And then it just erupted because the Liverpool fans knew 10 would be a Premier League record and they shouted, "We want 10. And it suddenly felt like a cup tie. So it was sort of a privilege to be there to go through all the different phases of celebration and so on. But at the heart of it, of course, you have a team that we have to ask, how will they recover from being humiliated? I mean, I gave a few players a 2 out of 10. I've not done that for a very long time.
Does "We want 10" come into the cruel chanting? Would that be cruel?
No, because as I've explained, Thomas Roddy, as I've explained, it was very respectful up until that point. And then it was purely about history. It wasn't about rubbing the noses of Bournemouth in it. It was about, wow, we could be, everyone wants to be present for a historic moment. And as one, everybody realised they could be there for that. But I did make the point
in my
match
report. We Want 10 does not fit into the category of, well, just because there's a good reason for chanting it, it's okay. I mean, it's like being one of the crowd when the gladiators were about to, you know, do away with someone and putting your thumb down, you know, and saying, yeah, we want blood. We want to see them dead, you know, drag them out, maybe decapitate them. You know, that's what you're asking for.
No, I was there. It didn't feel like that at all, Hugh. I can see how you might not understand that, but it was so respectful up until that point. It did not feel aimed at Bournemouth whatsoever. And everybody would have had huge respect for the travelling supporters because they were great. They were great. They didn't boo. They shouted, you know, Olé if a pass reached another Bournemouth player. I think that happened twice. You know, it's like, It was a proper respectful afternoon, and I could see why Klopp went to hug Parker, because, you know, you end up thinking, well, you know, you don't get extra points for winning 9-0. There's almost no need for it, really. So you could see how it was. He didn't gloat at all. But I do make the point. What is it about 10 that why have we had a few teams scoring 9 but not 10? Is that I wonder if there's a mental block that to reach double figures is to make a mockery of the Premier League being the best league in the world. It's almost as if that would be silly numbers. Does anyone agree that there might be a mental block on 10?
It was nearly 10, wasn't it? It was nearly 10.
Exactly. It should have been. It could have easily been 13.
Listen, if Mo Salah brought his shooting boots, it would have been 13.
Ah, well, that's another point. It was so easy that I think Mo Salah didn't have that kick of adrenaline you need as an elite player. It felt like a friendly or a kickabout for him, so he didn't have that sharpness.
Honestly, the Bournemouth fans have all turned off already. This is entirely disrespectful, Alison Rudd. You know, Mo Salah, one of the best players in the world. I look, maybe it's just that Mo's such a nice guy. He knew it was going to be 9, didn't want to give that record to the Bournemouth players. I don't know. He did lack something, but I think on a day that Liverpool score 9, you know, join the history books, we can't complain about any of their players, really. And that the mental block on 10, I can see what you're saying, because I think all the players know it's 9, don't they? Most players know it's 9. And 9 is, it's almost like they've had enough here. Come on, guys, you know, let's just pass it around for the last few minutes. No need to really go at them too hard, you know. 9, you've put yourself in the history books. Maybe once you hit 7, I think everyone's like, right, let's score 9. We'll be amongst elite company. And then it's like, okay, all right. You don't want to be those guys. You know, you don't want to be that person. So I think maybe there was a little bit of kindness from the Liverpool players. But we'll come back to that. There was a 9-0 in Scotland as well. So, you know, while we're on it, in fact, Alison, do you think there is a mental block? Is that why you think Liverpool didn't score 10? Why Celtic didn't score 10 against Dundee United?
Well, I've no idea why Celtic didn't score 10. I don't know what the history of score. I have a feeling there have been 10s in Scotland, to be honest. I'm talking about the Premier League and the fact that the minute you score double figures, maybe you undermine the word Premier, because that's the sort of score you get in comedy shows. I point out that in Ripping Yarns, which you're both too young to know, but you should seek it out. It was a Monty Python spin-off, and they did a football episode. And there's Michael Palin plays a guy called Gordon Ottershaw, whose team keep losing. And the scoreline that tips him over the edge and makes him wreck his house is 8-1. It's not 10-0. It's almost like in fiction, you don't go for 10-0 because that means it's not real professional football. It's what you get in kiddies football or park football or pub football. 10-0 sounds like not a premium product. I think that's a deeply subconscious thing.
What's interesting is it was, you know, that record where it began was so long ago, the Ipswich game, but yet we've seen a massive increase in the last few years on these high-scoring games. And if you last season, no, there were three teams that conceded more than 77 goals in the Premier League. If you go back 20 years ago, no team conceded more than 64 goals in the Premier League. And I just wonder whether there's a little bit of a mix between, or even like the evolution that perspective on managers needing to play nice, attractive football, even in those relegation positions, is opening up, is allowing for more goals to be conceded, allowing them to be opened up more. There isn't that kind of, we'll happily sit back for 90 minutes and fight for a nil-nil. They try and go for it from the minute go. There's that, and obviously the the obvious combination of the gap becoming even more of a gulf to big teams, to the top teams now.
Oh, that's a really interesting point, Tom, because that's like a dichotomy, isn't it? So, and you're backing up what I'm saying in a sense, because I'm saying it can't be a premier product if you have score lines that reach double figures, but you're saying it's also not going to be a premier product unless teams try and play attractive football, i.e. you can't be in the Premier League and just play hugely defensively 10 men behind the ball every game and hope to keep the score line to 1 or 2 nil. That's not acceptable either. So the outcome will be a few more big score lines.
Yeah, I think it's the perception of managers and how they see themselves has changed. There is a need to be more attractive, and if you're going to be in the premier product of the Premier League and progressing in that, because you know most managers are aspiring to be a top six manager, my team needs to play the same way they do. There's no this kind of Tony Pulis. You just rarely see the Tony Pulis and Neil Warnock style anymore of trying to snatch wins.
I think, Tom, there are a variety of reasons why, including sports science, fitness and strength, so the players can play for longer at an accurate level, if you like. So they don't really drop off in the same way as they might have when they were all out on the beers in the mid to late 90s. But I also think that, you know, at 3-0 back in the day, you might have taken players off, you know, and because they can't all get two-footed anymore and you can't, you know, the losing side can't start kicking players, you know, into the crowd, I think that gives the ability for the team that's on top to keep playing super beautiful football because they get the protection of referees. And that means that as we go into the second half, you know, there was no real difference between the fitness levels and the sharpness and the precision and the speed in the second half, at the start of the second half, as it was at the start of the first half. So, you know, there are a variety of factors, but I see where you're coming from. I felt for Bournemouth in this game. I mentioned a little bit earlier on that their lack of transfer activity. You know, the question is now there about what they're doing as a club, whether we're going to see a team that is, and I know they've won a game already this season, but is as poor as maybe the bottom two sides that we saw last season, to be perfectly honest. There's no point mentioning Derby County's 11 points, because I think when you look at what Norwich did last season, we're talking, what, 22, 23 points last year. You know, it doesn't represent a great image for the Premier League if clubs are going to, if you like, come up and not really go for it in the fashion that we'd expect from the sportsmanship, if you like. You know, you come to the Premier League, you know you're going to get 100 million. I know there's the argument between, do you want to be a Fulham or Nottingham Forest, spending loads of money, bringing loads of new players, maybe go straight back down anyway and it make no real difference, or just consolidate as a club in the way that Norwich have done, or maybe Bournemouth are doing at this point in time, by not splurging, not spending the cash, but ultimately looking like it means your season is wasted and you'll definitely go down. It will be tough to take for the Bournemouth fans, but it does point towards, you know, a long old season. What do you think, Tom?
The worry, I think, would be in the way that Scott Parker is talking at the moment, because it feels, and quite understandably, because of the transfer business, it feels like there are excuses already. And he, even after the Arsenal game, he was talking about the need to play in a different way, and that his players aren't getting that yet, that they played attractive football to get promoted from the Premier League and to survive in, to get promoted to the Premier League and then to survive there, you have to be a little bit more savvy, a little bit more resilient, and approach games in a different way. But and even that was, I think that was Marcos Senesi's first game. And, you know, it was a, it was one of those cliched welcome to the Premier Leagues when Gabriel Jesus absolutely barged him to the floor. And but the way in which Scott Parker is talking is like there are excuses already. We've not done the business in the transfer window. And so there's already a tone that suggests they don't believe they can survive. And we have seen that before with teams coming up, you know, the likes of Sheffield United. They didn't do significant amounts in the transfer market and still survived and thrived in the Premier League.
Yeah, there is an element of self-fulfilling prophecy about the heavy defeat at Anfield, because what Scott Parker said after the game about the club needs to make a decision, and no one's entirely sure what he means by a decision. I think it's probably just, are they going to go for it or accept their fate is the decision. And that's not entirely in Scott Parker's hands if he can't boost the squad, or if he feels that the general tone is one of, let's just take the money and run, but not run very hard. But it's, you, and I can see why, if you're the manager who's worked hard and got the club to be promoted on a relative shoestring compared to the other teams that came up, you feel you deserve to be able to build the team as you want it to be built. So I can see why he's been making those noises publicly. But if you make those noises publicly, then you're not equipping the players to have any belief that they can. They're being described variously as inexperienced or not at it or not being equipped. And if you're told that, then you're, I mean, that's exactly what they look like at Anfield. They look like a team that did not feel ready for this level, that they'd been promoted beyond their ability. And we all know underdogs can have their day, and with the right shape and team talk and attitude, you can always get a result, always can. But you're not going to get one unless you're confidence is boosted. So Scott Parker is treading a difficult path here. He's trying to make the board make decisions, but that has an impact on his team. And I do get the sense it could all spiral nastily out of control if something doesn't give. And there aren't many days left in the transfer window for anything to give. And then what happens? It's a very strange set of affairs, really.
What is the impact of, if you're one of the players in the squad, what does the impact of hearing your manager essentially say, we need new players? He's saying to you, you're not good enough. That's what you're hearing. But also, just to mention, despite all of this, there was, if anyone's not read it, Ali's excellent piece with Scott Parker on the, what was the name, Ali? You can explain it.
Well, Scott Parker allowed me to name it. So it was just very strange. So last December, Bournemouth scored a goal against Fulham from kickoff. It was four passes, shoot, goal. It was very, very highly detailed choreography. And it was copied by Real Madrid soon after. But then last weekend, it was copied a lot. It was still like everyone seemed to be copying it. And some teams, PSG scored, you know, after a few seconds because they scored from kickoff using exactly the same choreography. Other clubs did it and put thank yous out on Twitter. It was like sort of the rage of the week. And Scott Parker very kindly agreed to talk to me about how he devised it. But he said, I could give it a name. I said, this needs a name. And so I called it the AFCB four-step because that's what it is, four passes and shoot. And they're very precise passes. And he did say in that interview, it was one, that was just one of hundreds of work, pieces of work he does on set pieces to try and gain an advantage, knowing that, you know, they don't have the best players. So they try and work out, you know, marginal gains. He talks about marginal gains a lot, which is what you have to do if you're on the smaller clubs in the Premier League. So he does not lack in terms of application. The impression I got from him is someone who just spends hours and hours studying ways to to try and close the gap when you're playing against teams that have spent millions and millions and have attracted the best players in the world to them. And, you know, you won't find any football fan able to name the Bournemouth starting 11, even if, you know, you'd argue, what is the Bournemouth starting 11? But do you see what I'm getting at? He is working hard at finding other routes. So he's got the minutiae right, but the big picture talk feels wrong. It feels defeatist and counterproductive.
Well, I think he's going to need the other 99, to be perfectly honest with you, in terms of that meticulous planning. And, you know, no stone unturned might actually include having a look back at some of Tony Pulis's best wins, because in terms of closing the gap, 9-0, you know, a 1-0 defeat versus a 9-0 defeat, you know, you don't get any points out of the game. But when it comes to the end of the season and goal difference, you know, it might have a big, big effect. But yeah, it was a very disappointing weekend for Bournemouth and Scott Parker. Just very quickly, Alison, Roberto Firmino, 100th goal in Liverpool colours. You know, back through the middle, Diogo Jota injured, Darwin Nunez suspended. You know, got himself back amongst the goals. Really important for him. What do you think? Can he help Liverpool get back to that level of competing for the Premier League title?
Yeah, it was an important performance from him. He was at the heart of everything until he was taken off. Because he'd been written off. If you listen to all the build-up to this game, it was how, you know, Klopp's going to have to use Bobby Firmino. And, you know, he's really past his best. And he's, you know, this is not how Liverpool want to play anymore. You know, he's not very effective as a false number nine. He drops too deep. He doesn't get involved enough. He's lost his shooting boots. He's a player who's not what he was. And, okay, it was a weak Bournemouth. But the way he integrated with his teammates, the amount of ground he covered, his positioning was fantastic. He was popping up all over the place, but not in a random, annoying way, in a, you know, intuitive, clever way. So, you know, I was just really pleased for him, because I think the negativity surrounding him was not really deserved or appropriate. And he's still very much part of the team.
Well, 2 goals, 3 assists in the game. Very important for Roberto Firmino. Very important for Liverpool. As I said a few seconds ago, Tom, what do you think? Was it too quick to judge Liverpool in terms of the race for the Premier League title? Because I was one of those looking at their first few games thinking City are going to run away with this.
No, I don't think so. Because also, I don't think Bournemouth are the best measure for how good a team actually is right now. And also the fact that the Premier League is often won at these early stages now makes a difference. It still felt, even with that United game, that there are issues at Liverpool, and also the fact that one of the main ones is the injuries. You can't get away from that. So they do need those players back. And a little bit, it's kind of similar to Arsenal in the way of that Bournemouth game, because quite understandably, people are getting excited about Arsenal and their potential this year. And they have progressed massively from last season. But let's see what happens in October when they're facing Tottenham, Liverpool and City. When those big games are happening, the big teams are meeting each other, that's when we'll really see their kind of credentials.
Good weekend for Liverpool. Manchester City, though, they're forging something, aren't they? Especially at the Etihad Stadium. They came from 2 goals down for the second time this season. This time, though, it was a win. Erling Haaland helping them to a 4-2 victory at home to Crystal Palace with his first club hat-trick. And you know me, I'm a negative Nelly. So let's start with the fact that City have conceded 5 goals in their last 2 games. Is this defence going to be good enough when it really matters? Yes, that's where I'm starting on Manchester City. Alison Rudd.
Well, it doesn't matter, does it? Because going forward, they are the best at the moment. And I felt like this isn't a new thing this season. I felt like it's been like this for a couple of seasons with Pep Guardiola. He gets a bit bored, and it's only when they're behind that he starts showing some interest in the match anyway. Starts using, you know, making tactical tweaks, and the players sort of get a bit excited and they go into the fifth gear. I don't think their defense is great. It seems a bit risky to put all the eggs in the players he's gone for. There's not much depth in defense, but when you've got, they're not terrible, are they? They're not terrible. And they all understand the process. So when they decide they have to go and score a few goals or maybe more than a few goals, they'll do it. So yeah, and also I don't know, Edison this season has looked a little bit slightly off it. I would have put Edison and Alisson as like on a par, but I feel Alisson's moved ahead somehow. There's something a bit lackluster about Edison, but no, they are going forward. Just when they want to be, they are unstoppable, absolutely unstoppable. And I'd be really interested in the in going behind the scenes. This will never happen, of course. I'd love to go behind the scenes to see how, on a psychological dynamic, as a defence, knowing that you will always be helped out by your attack, whether that means you are overly relaxed, perhaps, because they always say, you know, any result is built from the back. But I sort of feel with City, their results are built from the front.
Happy with where City are?
Me personally, I'm not bothered where City are. what's actually quite curious about your point, Hugh, and the last two games, 5 goals conceded in the last 2 games, and totally different games as well. This wasn't... The two against Palace are quite methodic, smart plays by Palace. In the Newcastle game, you've got this kind of frenetic counter-attacks, which City were and are always going to be vulnerable to. And I do think the loss of, you know, Fernandinho is felt here a bit and will be felt this season, even with Rodri improving as he settles in. The arrival of Haaland just makes such a significant difference to them because of, as Ali said, he just allows them to get out of these scrapes. I think without him, even, you know, I know he scored a hat-trick yesterday, on Saturday, but even without him there, I don't think they win that game because they can just score so many different goals now. There was a way that City played and that we've got used to them playing, that he's fit in beautifully. And I think that's kind of important to talk about as well, because he is living up to expectation. I remember Michael McIntyre, the comedian, talking about how when you start out as a comedian, you're in these small shows and small, tiny venues, and no one really knows who you are. And their expectations are so low, and you're just impressing them. If you can make them laugh, you're impressing them. Then when you get to the size of being a stadium or arena comedian, the pressure is so high that it's actually a relief, because you've got a bar of comedy that you've got to meet. And it's exactly the same with Haaland this season, and players who arrive in the Premier League with such high expectation. And we've seen Romelu Lukaku fall short. We've seen so many players fall short that I do think it's worth pointing out how good he's been already and settled in so quickly.
5 games, 6 goals for Erling Haaland, got a hat trick already. I've decided this weekend that I don't like him. I don't like him. I don't like him, because who likes bullies? You know, no one likes a bully, number one. Number two, he styled himself like some sort of diehard baddie or someone that Jean-Claude Van Damme would fight as a kickboxer in the final scene of one of his action movies. He's the bad guy, okay? I don't care what anyone thinks, until he cuts his hair at least, all right? So that's all I'm saying. The way that he just dismissed the centre-backs like they weren't there was ridiculous. The speed as well. I mean, it's like stopping a bison as he's running through on goal. I mean, you got absolutely no chance, basically, or like a stampeding rhino. Do you know what I mean? It was an irresistible force. And in that regard, I don't like him. I hope he doesn't turn into a flat track bully. He's got so much talent. But the way he put away that third for the hat trick was, you know, unbelievable. Knowing you're on a hat trick, knowing it's the goal that basically seals the game, you know, he just puts it away with such aplomb. And it's just like, at that goal, I was like, okay, this is it. New Premier League legend on the way. We'll be talking about him, you know, in 15 years' time, scoring the goals of a Kane, or, you know, having the influence of a Drogba on his team, you know, and leading them to great things. And I imagine he will. It's just been a great start for him. He's always in the right area. That's the thing. I mean, it was pointed out on Match of the Day that his movement in the first half wasn't great. But then his movement in the second half was like elite, world-class goal scoring. It was, you know, for a player of his size as well, you know, to lose a player that big in basically the area of the six-yard box is something special, particularly when you got about six players back, but Crystal Palace somehow managed it. But I put that down to the talents of Haaland more than anything else. And it's ominous for the rest of the Premier League. If he can stay fit, we know he's had injury problems in the past, but if he stays fit, he's unbelievable.
There is a glimmer of hope for the rest of the division in that he could just get very bored, couldn't he? I mean, he spent the first 45 minutes, no one bothered passing to him. He wasn't involved. It must get quite tiresome, knowing you just have to wait for your moment. So if that happens a lot, where they sort of ignore him for two-thirds of a game, he might just switch off.
No. We are, unfortunately, Alison, looking at someone who just lives for scoring goals, and that is the moment that he waits for. And as long as he gets that moment, you know, it's like a Pippo Inzaghi. You know, it's someone who just hovers around the pitch. The rest of the players do all the work until that decisive pass, and then he's there for the finish. You know, and that's all that matters to him. And you see on the celebration that is what he's been waiting for all along. So as long as he gets that supply, he won't get bored. He absolutely will not get bored. But there is one more reason why I don't think we should like Erling Haaland. In his post-match interview, he called his manager Pep.
Utterly disgraceful
from Erling Haaland. It should not be allowed, okay? The gaffer, the boss, the manager, okay? First name basis. You just showed up, mate. Unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. And frankly, if you could give out a 3-match ban for that, then he should be getting one and missing the next few games. Okay?
What do you think Pep makes of that, though? Let's all call him Pep just to really rub it in. Because I remember writing a piece about Mikel Arteta, actually, when he arrived at Arsenal. He encouraged players to call him Mikel. And I felt that was a big mistake because of his age and the fact he played with one or two of them. You've got to create this distance. You have to be separate. You have to be slightly scary. You definitely have to be the authority figure. And you do not call the authority figure when it comes to football. You don't call your manager by his first name.
That's it. So City players, City fans, make sure he's calling him the gaffer by next week, okay? He'll learn that phrase very, very quickly, I'm sure. And he's learning things. He's picking up everything from the manager very quickly as well. Settled in nicely. Another comeback victory for Manchester City, which, again, because of that defence, I think we'll see more of. And it will maybe build this air of invincibility about them. We'll see how far they can go in the Premier League this season. But yeah, they've started off very, very well. Liverpool and Manchester City covered. We'll be talking about Aston Villa showboating and pick our player of the month after this on the game. Steven Gerrard is already under big pressure this season. 3 defeats in 4 games so far for Aston Villa. They were beaten 1-0 at home by West Ham this weekend. And they've got a big week ahead of them. Arsenal to come and Manchester City, the top 2 next. And really, I think he needs a recipe that works for him, Steven Gerrard. That is his job at the moment. He admitted after the game that up until the final third, his team are pretty good, but they are yet to find that attacking fluidity. And that is really important. I've said before, I think they've got a pretty decent squad. And I did say before the start of the season, for me, it was going to be one of two ways. Their record is pretty poor, not just this season, but at the back end of last season. And you have to say Villa, with high aspirations, needs something soon. Might not necessarily be results, but we need to see something from the manager that says he's got a plan. Maybe he just needs time. Alison, what do you think? What's going on at Aston Villa?
Well, it seems to have been distilled into how he sets up and integrates his best players, who are Ings, Watkins and Coutinho, in terms of attacking. And the general view seems to be he can't play all three at the same time. I would argue that isn't necessarily true. I mean, I could point to any number of clubs which integrates three very attack-minded players. It's because of the old playing with two number nines, isn't it? And I think everyone's maybe Gerrard too is getting bogged down in the negative element of that, the risk attached to doing that, when in fact you can surely get one of those number nines to do a different job. I mean,
as you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ollie Watkins, for example, he is so good at doing what managers want him to do, and he's quite tactically astute, and he can be defensively very good. He can drop deeper. He can move wide. There must be a way of integrating those three players. And the trouble is, the longer that becomes the dilemma, the more it has an impact on the rest of the squad, so that when he decides to drop one of them, then you think, well, we're not, what are we doing? Who are we? I thought we were going to be quite interesting attack-minded team here, play expansive football, and we're not. Why? What are we doing? So there is, I think, almost a lack of identity, which if Gerrard was forceful about how he integrated those three, you would say, oh, they do have an identity. You can see what Gerrard's trying to achieve here. Whereas at the moment, it just feels like an experiment, and there is a cloud of doubt over it, which stops it being as effective as it could be. I am slightly concerned from Villa's point of view that the impact Coutinho made when he joined them, it's being rewritten as he's now become a headache, and that is worrying, I think, because if you've got Coutinho playing well, and I love the way he brings other, you know, he's a very unselfish player, and he knits the team together, and he spots runs, and he has some willing runners in that team. So you'd want him there to knit it all together in an attacking sense. And if you're saying you can't fit him in, then what have you become? When the most beautiful football you've played has been because of a certain player, and then suddenly that's become a weight around the neck of the team. It's almost going backwards at Villa, and I think that needs Gerrard to be less polite. I don't know. Just go for it and decide how he's going to play.
Yeah, and also in a slightly similar way to Parker, I just find the tone of Gerrard especially after the West Ham game, showing that he's a guy who is really feeling the pressure this season. And that's absolutely, I wonder whether part of it is the fact that he's he's lost Michael Beale, who was his trusty assistant and, you know, was with him at Rangers, was with him in that first from November last year when he got the job at Villa, and has long been seen as a real tactical genius who took over at QPR, who have actually had a difficult start to the season. But that doesn't denigrate from him the role he would play as an assistant. We've seen that before with guys like Rui Faria with Mourinho, who was an excellent assistant coach, but then can't make it on his own as a manager. We saw it numerous times at Man United as well with assistance to Fergie, who then went on to have difficulties as managers in their own right. But the one thing I'd kind of say is Gerrard heard a lot of booing, and it's clear the fans are unhappy, and I totally get that, because you look at that team and you think exactly what Ali just said. Basically, you look at that team and there is so much more potential there that sometimes you think of one of the great coaches would be getting so much more out of them. But even with the fans already showing they're upset with the way Villa are playing, actually, I think Gerrard is going to get patience, and quite a lot of patience, because of the relationship he has with Christian Perslow, the chief exec of Villa, who has wanted him there for a long time since their relationship going back to the Liverpool days. He's wanted him there for a long time. So to give up early would surprise me. But as you said, Hugh, the ambitions of that club are huge. The finances there and the potential. You know, we talk a lot about Newcastle and where they're going. I think Villa have similar expectations.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you on that. I think they want to be in Europe. A consistent team in Europe would be the first step for them. Whether Steven Gerrard was going to be the manager that would immediately deliver that, or whether he was there to just, you know, maybe make them a regular top half team. I remember saying when he was appointed, such a great place for Steven Gerrard to go. Agree with you on the relationship with Christian Perslow, because I felt he would get three seasons. Whatever happened, he would get three seasons. But you look at 6 wins in 22 in all competitions at the end of last season. If he loses to Arsenal and Manchester City this week, it's 5 defeats in the first 6 at the start of this year. You know, I often now think of the Arsenal and Mikel Arteta situation as a real game changer in the thoughts of me, maybe a lot of fans as well, about giving the manager time. You know, an inexperienced manager, Mikel Arteta had no managerial experience. At least Steven Gerrard had done something special with Rangers, a title winner, semi-finalist in the European competition. And because of that, you almost think, well, you got to give him some time. You know, he's shown elsewhere that he could be a very, very good manager. And although he's signed some players, the squad isn't entirely his. This is his first summer transfer window. And those players will need time to bed in. He will need to learn what they're like as players and people around him. But you just wonder whether the aspirations will be too much for the owners. You know, they have spent money over the past few seasons. They do want things to go well at Aston Villa. And the big one is, it's a decent squad. It's far above what we're seeing at the moment. And so you almost feel like, could there be another manager? And that question will linger, that can get more out of them. Tom?
It's interesting that you draw the comparison to Mikel Arteta, Hugh, because also Gerrard's tried to stamp his authority on Villa in the same way that Arteta did, in taking away the captaincy from Mings. And when Arteta did it with Aubameyang, that was a strong move to make. You know, this is a goal scorer and you haven't got loads of them in your side. But he went on in those games that followed that to win. And Villa are struggling, and Mings is a real popular figure in that dressing room. So you do wonder the impact that decision has actually had and whether it might have backfired a little.
Alison, do Villa need to amend their aspirations, at least for this season, if they're going to stick by Gerrard?
Well, that's a funny way of putting it. So Gerard will be allowed to stay if he reaches a target, and the target is, what, 20 points by Christmas? I mean, you know, is that's ridiculous. They what they want, first of all, I think, is to find... I think they do want a dynasty there, and they do want it to feel like this is long-term and they're building something great. But what they need, all they need, is for it to look convincing. I don't think, I think there would be patience if they dropped points now and again along the way, maybe got a few unlucky draws. But everyone wants to see a trajectory. And what we're seeing is that Gerard came in, and his fame and his aura as an excellent former player gave the team buoyancy. And you felt, oh, you know, once they all get to know each other and work out what they want, you know, we'll see a trajectory. And we're not. We're seeing it going the wrong way. And that him just existing, him just being there isn't enough. They need to, it's worrying, I think, that it's going in the wrong direction. It needs to be arrested soon. But I agree with Tom completely, is that they were so keen, Christian Perslow was so keen to attract him. It would be a major blow to him personally to have to say, I made a mistake in appointing Steven Gerrard. So they're sort of trapped. Maybe he just needs, like Tom's indicated, he just needs a superb number two to come in and reinvigorate his coaching style. But I think it's a bit odd to say you lower expectations in order to keep the manager in the job. That doesn't normally happen.
Not in order to keep him in the job, but if you really believe in him and you know there are going to be ups and downs, don't you say, well, look, we all hoped for the best, but it's going to take longer than we thought it was. Steven Gerrard's our man, and that means we don't put as much pressure on being a top eight side this season. We say, look, okay, next season, that's going to be the aim. This year it might be top 12, for example.
But at the moment, finishing ninth is looking like beyond them. They lost to Bournemouth, for goodness sake. This is not a team in... great shape.
The funny thing is, as well, is that they did attract an excellent number two, because they got Neil Critchley to go from being a number one, a first choice manager at Blackpool, to come to be number two at Villa. And I think he paid very well for that job. But it doesn't always, just because you are a great coach, it doesn't mean you're going to come in and have that natural fit. I mean, everything you hear about João Sacramento, who was Mourinho's assistant at Spurs, before he went there, he was just a godsend in coaching circles and the up-and-coming figure. But his approach to players meant that it didn't work out. And the relationship with Mourinho, eventually, after he went to Roma, eventually fell apart. So sometimes it's that, you know, whether Michael Beale and Gerrard had this beautiful kind of blend that the likes of Pochettino and Jesus Perez had, that maybe Critchley and Gerrard don't. I'm not entirely sure, but it's a curious kind of factor.
I'm going to talk about Tottenham Hotspur next. Not really going to examine their performance, though. They earned a 2-0 win over Nottingham Forest, continue their unbeaten start. For me, still not a title challenging side yet. Nottingham Forest had 56% possession, 17 shots in the game. Shows you the effect that they had and could have this season, especially at home, if they put in some more performances like that. Spurs, on the other hand, had 18 shots. And ultimately, their talisman, Harry Kane, the difference, already motoring pretty nicely this season as well. But we wanted to talk about Richarlison, who seems absolutely dead set on keeping, you know, his role in the Premier League as being almost the biggest thorn in the side to all opposing fans going for as long as possible. He revels in it. I've got to say, he absolutely revels in it. So his silky showboating at times at the City Ground, not really welcome by the fans or some of the opposing players, who I think had to show him, you know, in response. You've got to stop someone from showboating, and you've got to do it in a strong fashion. That's all I'm going to say. You've got to send a message, okay? And I'm fully behind sending a message to anyone, very good skills, by the way, Richarlison, but anyone showboating in that fashion, okay? I'm fine. You know, you've got to have an enforcer. You've got to send a message. This is about respect. Alison Rudd, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, this brings us all the way back to Liverpool 9, Bournemouth 0. You didn't see any Liverpool player showboating when they could easily have done so. You just don't do it. And it would be, I would have been fine with Richarlison doing some keepy-uppy if Spurs had been losing. You think, well, that's an interesting way of approaching life. But he does it because they're winning. And he feels he's made a considerable contribution to that result. And he wants people to look at him and he wants people to know how important he's been in that performance overall. So it's very selfish. It's very silly. And you can, you, if you're very good at keeping up, players tend to do it in the warm-up or when they're warming up before they come on, or there are moments you can do it as you walk onto the pitch, you can do it. In a game, during a game, when you're away from home, it's rude. Basically, it's rude. It's like turning up to a dinner party without any wine. Don't do it, please.
I loved it. And I think Conte will love it because it kind of mirrors it, just Richarlison as a whole, not just this moment, but Richarlison as a whole sort of mirrors what Conte is and what he wants to bring to a team and turn Tottenham into this. I'm really interested as to why you're laughing, Hugh.
I totally agree with you, which is why I'm laughing, because you're making a brilliant point. I totally agree with you.
I just think Tottenham for so long have been this nice, friendly side who get the label of Spursy, which isn't necessarily about being nice and friendly and lovely, but just a little bit weak. And it was funny that it happened at Forest. And it made me think that Richarlison, he's one of these guys who just thrives in those environments. And you could see watching the game how intense it was, not on the pitch, but just the atmosphere that's created there. And he's the guy who is going to throw a flare into the crowd. And we're not condoning that. But he's going to have these moments like the keepy uppies, like the flare. And it slightly reminds me of when Conte had Diego Costa at Chelsea, in that kind of character who plays on the edge, likes to wind people up. And it's probably not the best comparison to draw because of the fact Conte dumped Costa, and with Richarlison he's bringing him in. But I just think he will, his presence and the type of person he is just reflects what Conte wants Tottenham to become.
He'll get his leg broken.
This is what I was going to say, okay? I don't mind anyone showboating. If you want to showboat, fine, all is fair in love and war. But when someone comes over and puts a reducer on you, I think's the term, then you just got to take it. You know, you wanted to goad someone. And if they respond and if they react, that's fine. And I actually think the referees need to be lenient in that case. Okay, we all talk about a high bar for officials and all that. Well, if someone is showboating, taking the mick, a couple of goals up, not long to go in the game, and someone goes over and go straight through them, well, fine. I wouldn't even give a yellow card, as far as I'm concerned, because if someone wants to goad you on a football pitch, that is going to happen. And I don't care if it's Sunday League, I don't care if it's the Premier League, it's fine, okay? And referees need to know that. In fact, that should be in their pre-season directive. If someone showboats, you can do whatever you want to them, all right? As long as it's below the kneecap, fine.
Thank God it's Howard Webb and not Hugh Woozencroft who's in going into the PGMOL.
Listen, I'll do a better job, believe me, because this week, I'm not even going to do it as a talking point. I'm just going to underline that we have a VAR crisis in this country. Add it to the multitude of crises currently ongoing, okay? And in fact, footballers should strike soon. That's how bad VAR is. This week's VAR crisis, which I imagine will be a feature every Monday, came at Chelsea, where despite Ruben Loftus-Cheek throwing himself to the ground in some sort of WWE-style, judo-style role, a penalty was given against Youri Tielemans, who was just trying to nudge a little shoulder on Ruben Loftus-Cheek. Don't know where the violent reaction came from, for Loftus-Cheek to throw himself to the ground. It was a forceful dive. That's how I describe it. And I immediately thought, well, there's no way VAR will allow this penalty to stand. And it did, okay? Believe me, they've got no idea what's going on at the moment in the PGMOL when it comes to reversing decisions, changing decisions, what's clear and obvious, what they should ask the referee to check. There's just no consistency there. And I was delighted to see the penalty chalked off due to an offside in the build-up. But believe me, had that penalty stood, it would have been a disgrace. There was absolutely no motion from Yuri Tielemans that would have led Ruben Loftus-Cheek, who's about a foot taller and about a stone heavier, to go to the ground like that. And I cannot believe the officials bought it. No talking point this week. I'm just going to bring that back, okay? Every Monday, this weekend's VAR crisis in the Premier League. And I'll be naming names next weekend, okay, PGMOL? So behave yourselves. Finally, though, on the game podcast, rant over. What, Alison? I said rant over.
No, all I was just going to say the game podcast is just the format for you to have some therapy. Clearly, that's why we exist. We're cheaper with therapy than the.
Do you think that was therapy? Do you think that makes me feel any better?
I think it does. Venting makes you feel better.
It really doesn't. I just want to see a game. I want to see a weekend free of these ridiculous decisions. Setting a higher bar is unbelievable. You set a higher bar and then things are overturned with ease one weekend. It's like, hold on a minute. So it's a higher bar when the referee's out there blowing the whistle. But for VAR, there is clearly no higher bar. So that's all I'm saying. I don't get it. Why even say that you're going to, decisions aren't going to be given as easily, blah, blah, blah. I don't get it. VAR, again, you're so bored of it. I'm bored of it. I've been saying it to you for how long? VAR light will not work. Either enforce the laws of the game as they're stated or don't. That's all I'm going to say, right? I'm moving on. Moving swiftly on to our final item of the game podcast. Each and every month on the game podcast, we're going to be choosing our player of the month, which could lead to some debate, some conjecture, or maybe we'll all be in agreement. Anyway, you will get the chance to decide the game podcast at player of the month once we put forward our nominations. And this week, we're going to be joined by Molly Hudson. Every week, you're going to get at least four players from whom you can judge. So, Molly, hi, how are you? Might as well start with you. Welcome to the game podcast. Who have you gone for player of the month?
I think that I have been heavily influenced by this weekend, to be fair. Obviously watched Nottingham Forest yesterday, and I think it's another one of those games where Nottingham Forest have lost, but I was really impressed with Dean Henderson. Obviously yesterday he saved the penalty from Harry Kane. He's also saved one from Declan Rice. I think it was quite a bold move. Quite clearly, he wasn't going to play at Manchester United, and obviously that's been quite publicly discussed. But I think it's always a bold move for a goalkeeper to go to a team that's kind of won the relegation favourites, I suppose, because you're going to be very busy, and for a goalkeeper that can work both ways, it's a positive that you are probably going to make quite a lot of eye-catching saves, but at the same time, most weeks you're probably going to concede it. It's going to Nottingham Forest, you're not going to expect to get a lot of clean sheets in a season. So I think he's done really well. I think his overall play was pretty impressive against Spurs as well. And I think, certainly watching that game yesterday, Forest are a decent team. And I think of all the players that they've brought in, if they are going to stay up, I think Henderson could be the one that makes the biggest impact, because ultimately, you can have as many goal scorers as you want, but if you're going to concede a lot of goals, then you're going to struggle. And I think, Harry Kane said some nice things about him as well after the game yesterday. And I think, obviously, with the World Cup on the horizon, that battle for that kind of third goalkeeper, assuming that Jordan Pickford goes as number one and Aaron Ramsdale probably goes, because obviously Arsenal are playing well again, whether it's Nick Pope or Dean Henderson, I think both have been sort of fantastic these early weeks of the season. But for me, it's probably Dean Henderson, just because of the expectations we probably have for Forest and the amount of goals they'll concede. I think he's already sort of standing out to me as a real key player for them.
Well, Dean Henderson, that is a strong nomination to begin with. Tom Roddy, who have you gone for?
We spent the whole of last season basically saying how Brighton were missing a striker, the guy to finish chances. And even though I still think they're kind of missing that, what they have never had a problem with doing is creating chances. And the guy who does that for them is Pascal Gross. And when you look at the influence that he has on games, it's quite staggering for a team like Brighton Hove Albion. They're only, since the beginning of last season, only James Ward-Prowse has played more passes into the box or created more chances from a team outside the traditional top six. And Graham Potter was talking this weekend about the fact they don't have a Salah or a Haaland, a player who stands out. But in Pascal Gross, they kind of do. And whether it's just a case of him fitting into their system beautifully, I'm not sure. But he's reached the age of 31 now. And he's been there since 2017 at Ingolstadt before. He's definitely not been the star of any team in particular until now. And even now, I think he's just an underrated player. And the fact he is 31, I'm not quite sure we're going to see him be the next on this miraculous conveyor belt of players who are making Brighton millions of pounds following Ben White and Mark Cucurella out of the club for a big money move. But this season, I think teams are going to have to basically concentrate on him to stop Brighton.
Alison Rudd, you obviously haven't gone for a Liverpool player. Have you chosen?
No, I've gone for the sometimes sunny, sometimes sulky Serb, Alexander Mitrovic. He broke all the records in the championship, goal after goal after goal. No one has ever scored more than him. He did it with ease, with games to spare. He was just scoring for fun. And yet, still, everybody said he won't cut it in the Premier League. He'd been there before, not shone. And they just wrote him off. And lo and behold, he's proved everyone wrong by being... He's been himself. He's carried on where he left off. He's been absolutely a pain in the neck for defenders to deal with. He's very bullying, but remarkably, he's managed to always be on the right side of the bullying. So he's not getting penalised a lot by referees for being physical. They're seeing that he does it most, for the most part, it's within the rules. And he's just a nightmare for defenders. He's scored four goals already in the Premier League. I mean, it's astonishing. It's not just the goals, his influence, the impact he has in a game. He was even humble enough to admit, even though he got cross Arsenal's winning goal at the weekend, afterwards he said, oh, I've looked at it again and it was fine. It was fine. I mean, how many strikers do that? I just think he's been everything the pundits said he couldn't be. And it's always lovely when that happens because he's an excellent player for club and country. And he's missed a penalty already this season and he's missed crucial ones for his country. But he comes back, he bounces back, he has great self-belief. He's a great team player. I don't think Fulham would have a chance possibly of staying up without him. But him in this mood and the intensity Fulham want to play with, this time around Fulham are not trying to play pretty football. They are being ugly when necessary. They're high intensity. That atmosphere really suits Mitrovic. And the fact that he just all those critics now look foolish, I think he is definitely the player of the month.
I'd have to disagree because I'm going for Gabriel Jesus of Arsenal because I think he's had the biggest impact so far in terms of the new signings. I know we were talking about Haaland a little bit earlier on and he's going to score a hatful of goals. But I think the final piece of the jigsaw to that Arsenal front line is Gabriel Jesus. Tenacious, footwork. He sniffs the ball out. He's just about around everything that they do well at the moment in terms of that forward line. They've had a perfect start to the season. He's brought that energy, that happiness to his game, to the Emirates Stadium as well. They're going to sell a hatful of G. Jesus shirts. I'm sure they will. But yeah, I just think he has been... Oh, maybe not the standout player. There's been a lot of good players so far, but the standout difference in a team compared to last season. Now, maybe that's unfair to a host of players, but I definitely feel like it has to be Gabriel Jesus. So he's my nomination. That is your nomination number four. Dean Henderson, we've got Alexander Mitrovic. Tom, you've gone for Pascal Gross, and I have gone for Gabriel Jesus. All right, so those are your four nominations. Make sure you check them out. On the Times app, you can vote there. We'll also post it onto social media. You will make the decision for Player of the Month. We will discuss the results, as always, we will, on the Game podcast. And thank you guys for being such incredible company for the past hour. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Molly Hudson, Tom Roddy, Alison Rudd, and to you for listening. Remember, you can subscribe to the podcast right now, so make sure you do wherever you're listening to your podcast. Check out the Times app as well, thetimes.co.uk/thegame.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.